John chapter 1, looking at verses 6 through 8, and then picking up in 14. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. And the Word, who is the light, who is the life, became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came from Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." Thus far, the Word of God, the Word. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when beginning the series on the Gospel of John that this book is quite unique from the other Gospels. That is not to take away from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for they each tell this glorious story in their own ways of the Messiah in his birth, his life, teaching, death, and resurrection. Those accounts are critical to our understanding of God's plan of redemption through Jesus Christ the Son. But John paints a different picture in a number of ways. We've already begun to see them unique to this gospel are these ideas and concepts which are found only there. They're ideas that are outside the mortal scope of things, beyond time itself even as it stands. Terms and names and descriptions of Christ that are found only here that uniquely describe all the many facets of the Savior. Of glimpses of heaven. Here they're In the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. That gives us a glimpse of this divine fellowship that had always existed there. And then the effect of that fellowship coming into the world of men in the most positive ways imaginable. These big, glorious, awesome, world-changing, heart-changing ideas that we see in John. As a matter of fact, one theologian who I appreciate and admire, William Hendrickson, he's long gone to be with God, once called the Gospel of John the most amazing book that was ever written. Those are high words indeed. So this is the Gospel that we're looking at. It's amazing, of course, because of the many ways that it shows Jesus Christ to be who he is. And as we pick up today, I hope you'll see that a little bit more in these verses. So in chapter 1, we've been introduced to some of these terms that are bigger than life, if you would. They're huge. For instance, the Word. Well, we use words every day, some of us in the hundreds, some of us in the tens of thousands every single day. But to call someone the Word, well, what does that even mean? It's a big idea. It's so big that it's hard to get our minds around the concept, even though we try. Same thing with the idea of life. We've got it. It's all around us. It's here in the trees and the animals and one another. But what does it mean for the Word to be life? It's a big, broad concept. It's an idea, if you will. Same thing with light. There is the light. It is bright. It is hot. There's another one on this pole back here. That's another type of light. We're well familiar with lights. But what does it mean for the Word to be the light of men? Well, I've spent some time trying to explain that, as many others have over time. It's an idea, though, when it boils down to it. It's an idea. It's a glorious one. It's a biblical one. But we're limited. We're limited in understanding what it means because we are human and our natures are fallen. And it's an idea that's so big that it's hard to get our minds around it. Therefore, the Word, who is the light of men, who is the life, determined to make these truths a little more clear to us. This reminds me, all this, of something that I learned to do in college some 30 years ago in the undergraduate program of industrial design at Auburn University, and that was brainstorming. You've heard that term. You've probably done it in some form or fashion, but as an industrial design student, industrial design students develop the art of designing products, much like an architect would design buildings, industrial designers design products. One of the ways that they formulate that or come up with these ideas is to brainstorm, and that is a very interesting process by which you sit down and you begin sketching, and you sketch out ideas, as many ideas as you can, on paper. It's a way in which your brain works uninhibited. You don't start processing and editing things right up front. You just let the ideas come forth, and that way you can get some good ones. But you can get some pretty wild stuff too when you brainstorm. Our class used to get a kick, as I remember, about sharing one another's brainstorming sketches together. You could get a real laugh that way. You might see, for instance, and remember, this is back in the 80s and early 90s, so a lot of things that we take for granted now hadn't been invented yet, but you might see a robotic vegetable slicer with 10 knives that cost $50,000 a unit to manufacture and would instantly threaten your life as soon as you flip the on switch. Or you might see the beginnings of a revolutionary new idea that would change for the better people's lives. That's what brainstorming could lead to. So what happened with these ideas of word and life and light? Well, they were, in a sense, put down on paper, much like the ideas I've just been talking about are put down on paper so that you can actually see them. These big ideas, God put down on us, put down for us, not on paper, but in life, in real life, so that we could see they were revealed to us not simply as ideas, but in reality and in a way that would improve the end user's life in the most positive way imaginable. But first, we need to back up and look at the text. The messenger. We'll talk about the messenger for a moment. The world had to be prepared for these ideas to be written down into our lives. And so there was a messenger that went forth, a herald. I think of a herald going before the king, playing the trumpet. For Americans, we're familiar, or perhaps when the president gets off a plane, often there will be the Marine band there playing Hail to the Chief. That's a way in which he is heralded when he hits the tarmac. The Word has a herald too. The Word. His name was John. It's not John the Apostle who wrote this gospel. It's another John, the one called the Baptizer, John the Baptist. He's not described for us here, but he is in the other gospels, and I'll read one from Matthew 3:4. Now John wore a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locust and wild honey. He was an eccentric figure, to say the least. He was a Nazarite. That means he had taken lots of vows in his pursuit of worshiping God and following God. Uncut hair and uncut beard, if you can imagine that, living in the desert. He's not what you would expect, if you think about it, to be the herald of the greatest figure in human history. He's not what you would expect. If he walked into church, if we were in there, and he walked into church one day, you would probably be wishing that he would sit in someone else's pew beside yours. He would be, we would do a double take when we saw John the Baptist. And in terms of brainstorming, John would be the sign of a really crazy idea in the works. I mean, just a really crazy one going on. So let's just say that when the idea of the Word, that is the Messiah, that is Jesus Christ, was put down into the reality of men, it wasn't what we were expecting. It was not at all what we were expecting. But John was expected. John himself was expected. He was prophesied from of old. Malachi, 500 years or so before this, had said that one like Elijah, the prophet before Malachi, who would come bearing news of the great and awesome day of the Lord. And then Isaiah talked about a voice crying from the wilderness, making straight a highway to the Lord. So this figure, John, this man, was prophesied from of old. He would be a figure who was great in Jewish history, the announcer of the Messiah. This would make him quite a famous figure as it stands. He would have been revered by his people. But the gospel account makes it clear right up front, right here in verse 8, that John wasn't to be the object of praise, not John. And then John himself in verse 15 declares that he thinks the same. He's outranked. The one that's following him outranks him. Why? Because he came before me. Because he's God. Because he came first. He is the Creator. Not only is the Messiah, he's been there from before the foundation of the world. He's more important than I am. It's not me. He's God himself. In Mark 1:3, John says this, and this is also indicative of how he viewed himself. I'm not worthy to untie the straps of the sandals of the one that comes after me. I'm not even unworthy to bend down and untie his shoes. Now, there's an object lesson for us here. It's not the main lesson today of the text, but there is definitely an object lesson, so I'll diverge for just a moment. You see, John was a great man, though by appearances a strange one. He was a great man in that he was pointed to from the Old Testament, and he knew it. And other people would have known it as well. And he was remembered in the New Testament. He is documented throughout history. He gave his life for this great task of faith. His name is recorded there long after most leaders of this world have been forgotten. We still know of John the Baptist, and we look up to him for his faith. He is famous in every sense of that word. But this story is not about him. It's not about John, as great of a faith figure as he is. It was and is about someone much greater than John, about the one who was coming into the world. John knew that. Do we? Do we know that? Do you realize that this story here, the one that you are leading, is not all about you? It's not all about me. My story here is not all about me. It's not even primarily about me. Fallen humans are very skilled at what I call, what I once heard and what has stuck with me all these years. We're very skilled at this art of navel gazing. That is introspection. That is self-absorption. Navel gazing. I can't bend down that far to look at mine anymore. But it just means looking inward, always looking at oneself, being concerned with oneself, all the details of one's life, over, always, 100%. But it's not about us. Our lives are not primarily about us. It was and is still about the one that John was announcing into the world. And our lives will ultimately be defined in how we relate to that one. It's not who we are, it's who he is and how we relate to him. That's how we will be defined for all eternity. Who is that one? Well, it's the Word that we've been talking about these last 2 weeks. The Word who is God, who was with God, who is the life and the light of men, all these concepts, all these ideas, in verse 14, now come down to us, as it says, in the flesh, the Word. The Word was born then, a human being. The idea was put down on paper. And the Word was born man without giving up his godhood. You need to know that. That's an ancient heresy. He didn't come down and give up godhood. No, he gave up some of the elements of godhood. He gave up the glory for one. He came down here. This is not heaven. One ancient theologian said, when the Son of God became human, he did so not by ceasing to be divine and transforming into human. Instead, without ceasing to be what he was, he became what he was not. He became man at the same time remaining God. He became, though, for the purposes of this passage and this story, he became one of us. He became one of us. He joined our ranks. He stooped down here. Now, I want you to realize what that means. It does not mean you all, I'm sure, at least, okay, so the younger families know what Pixar is. The grandparents know what Pixar is because they've seen it with their grandchildren. He was not some sort of super baby in a Pixar movie. That's not what this is indicating for us here. When the Word became flesh. In the Christmas hymn, what child is this? One of the lines of the traditional tune says, the virgin sings her lullaby. The virgin sings her lullaby. Why is that? What does that indicate? She was comforting a real baby. One who needed comforting. One who was helpless in every way. Just like we were. Just like our children are when they're born. He was the real thing. He did not have a cape on when he came here. When he was born in the flesh, that means he was born squarely into the same condition that we are. He was fully human. He had a human name. Jesus. And yet still the Word, still God, still with God. His cousin, this same John the Baptist, was born just a few months before him. John was probably trying to crawl about the time the Word became flesh. So the text jumps here in and out of time. I know you can see that. John is not a chronology of events. It shares ideas and concepts. And one of these is this messenger right in the middle of things. But it's all about the Word. It's all about Jesus. Now, I want to talk to you as we conclude today about another concept, very important. So the Word was born to us. The Word became flesh. But then the Word dwelt among us. Now, I know this sounds like a Christmas text, an Advent text. And it very much is, but it's a text for each and every moment of our lives if it boils down to it. Verse 14, the verse says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In the Greek, the verb dwelt has kind of a more illustrative meaning, more descriptive meaning. It literally is translated pitch the tent. Pitch the tent. I didn't know Coleman was in existence back then. REI, I didn't know they were selling tents. Tents have been around a long time, long before we started selling them at outlets. The word tent, the idea of tent, would have immediately made the Jewish listener think of something, be reminded of their past, a very revered part of their past. If you're thinking of tents, perhaps you remember back in the wilderness when they wandered. They made a tent. It was a tent described by God to Moses, the parameters of making this particular tent. It was called the tabernacle. What was that tabernacle? It was the predecessor of the temple, of Solomon's great temple. It was the place where people worshiped God. But more essentially, it represented for them the place where God was, where He came down and dwelt among them, watching over them, traveling with them throughout all those years, caring for them, loving them, sustaining them, feeding them. So to put that into the context of the Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us, there's that element of God watching over His people. But there's this added layer of meaning that comes with the Word made flesh. Another way of thinking about it is the fact that Jesus dwelled among us, and that makes us think of Him, in a sense, camping out among us, living in community with us, close community as one of us. Camping's not fancy, is it? Living right down here among the masses is another way to consider what that is saying. He was literally here on earth in plain sight to people, living just like they did, suffering the same conditions they did back then. Plagues, drought, heat, cold, illness, persecution from the government. He lived as one of them, as one of us, fully experiencing human life with all its ups and downs. The wedding feast to the loss of a loved one. He experienced it just like we do. Now, why did He do that? Why did He do that? It was not, I can tell you this, it was not so that He could get to know us. He knew us already. He knows everything about us. He always had. He always has. He knows you better than you know yourself. He knew you from before time began. It wasn't so He could get to know us better. I think that's important. It's so that we could get to know God better, that we could get to know God's nature, His attributes, His desires for us, His teaching to us, so that we could get to know God better. Because you see, Jesus is the very picture of God. Jesus the Son is the picture of God the Father. And so by Him coming down, Him coming to life, we could know more clearly and fully who God was. It helps us with these big ideas about God that could be written down but not fully grasped. You know how it is. You know how it is when you hear of something. I think of math. Oh, I try not to think of math too much, but I remember math, and I remember trying to learn it and struggling with something, and then all of a sudden it clicks, and I can do that problem. Maybe you remember that too. But that's kind of what Christ did. Him coming in flesh helped us in part to understand God better, more clearly. But there's a second reason that He came. And that is by knowing God more fully, by seeing Him in the flesh, that we would be drawn to Him and that we would yearn for Him. And that we would see that He and He alone is the way to escape this curse of sin that we are under. This curse that the effects are all around us each and every day. Even beyond the coronavirus, you are sitting there and I'm standing here with the effects in my life. We're hurting in various ways. Maybe today you're not here with grief in your heart. But some of us are. Some of us have lost loved ones. Some of us are physically hurt. Some of us have fractured relationships, and we struggle with them throughout the years. Some of us are lonely. Some of us can't find our way in life, what we're supposed to do, something that gives us satisfaction. Some of us have bitterness that we carry from old hurts. Bitter for years. Some of us are fearful of what will happen or could happen. We're all sitting here with the effects of sin. And Jesus came in the flesh among us to help us to be drawn to the escape, to the one single answer, that the curse would be lifted. The law is mentioned here. The law that was given to Moses. Moses was a good and faithful man. The law is good. The law is a reflection of God's own character and of what He wants of us. But the law is impossible. We have sat here in these few minutes, and all of us broken the law in our hearts in some form or fashion. The law is impossible. And in part, God gave it to us so that it would point us to the Word, to Christ, for our need for Him. Something besides ourselves. And Jesus is the only fulfillment of that law. He's the only answer. He is the Word and the life. The fulfillment of the law points to His sacrifice for us. He was worthy. He was sinless. He died for us. He fulfilled the requirements of the law on the behalf of any who would believe and trust in Him. And so He gives us, as it says in verse 16, what a precious three words. Grace upon grace. Grace upon grace. That's what we get for placing our trust in Him. Not curse, not condemnation. Grace upon grace. This was a crazy idea. I'll be the first to admit it. This whole thing, as it came to pass. God becoming man, leaving heaven for earth. Who would do that but God? If it felt like we were in heaven right now, I guarantee you none of us would want to leave it. It was heaven for Him, and He did anyway. And then among many other things, the whole birth, we didn't even talk about all the details of the birth. But think of this character of John. He was something to behold, and this was the chosen messenger for Jesus. It just defied conventional thinking. And then Jesus, living the way He did, going through all He did voluntarily. But it's a story that makes sense to our hearts. It doesn't make sense to our minds. It never will. But it makes sense to our hearts. It's the only one that can, in my view. Otherwise, we are left to try to find some other meaning for these years of life. Short years. And I don't need to tell you that in this day and time and place, and every day and time and place, the world can be a very hard place. If we make our story about ourselves, that is, about our time in this world, then we miss out on the life and the light that Jesus brings to us. We struggle with relationships. We pursue wealth and pleasure. We seek for meaning all around us. And we're anxious. We're anxious about our health. If you're anxious about your health in these days, and that's quite possible, most of us have at least consider being anxious about our health some lately. Quit it. Quit being anxious. Be cautious. Okay, be cautious. Use common sense. That seems to have been abandoned by some people. But don't be anxious. If there's one thing I can promise you, it is that your health will not last, nor will mine, one way or another. It will not last. There is an end. As big as an issue as health is, there are more important things even than health. And if you focus on health or any other aspect that I've mentioned, you will miss the bigger story that is available to you. You will have exchanged, as the Scriptures tell us, the truth for a lie. darkness for light. Jesus came that we might have life and have it abundantly. The story seems fantastical. It seems like a fairy tale, but it is the most real story in existence. It's the only one that works in the long term, of God coming down to make His dwelling among us that we might trust and so make our eternal dwelling with Him. Will you? Amen. Let us pray.